went down to the river, washed my sins away. Praying for another day. I went down to that river, washed my sins for free. The devil's on the other bank, staring back at me. I'm a dead man walking. I'm a dead man walking. I'm a dead man.
Welcome to Ars Politica podcast. Today, I'm going to talk about liberty of conscience. This is one of those topics that everyone affirms liberty of conscience, and then they believe that few people in the past or in church history also affirmed liberty of conscience, when in fact, practically everyone did, at least in principle or in writing. And I do, despite what people say. And I figured it would be good to talk about chapter 9 of my book, The Case for Christian Nationalism, and really kind of dive into what is the issue, what is the statement of the question, as I like to call it, and the old folks used to call it. What is the actual issue or question between us? I'd posit and I'd join, a venerable dead theologian such as Samuel Rutherford in saying that there's a serious misunderstanding of what is actually at issue. And so if you read, anything, for the most part, written by either it's Baptists or it's written by your modern Two Kingdoms folks, you'll hear that, well, in the past, in theocracy, they punished people simply for having a bad belief. And, someone said something and it's God's duty for you to smash and crush and destroy them. The New England persecutions, that this is what they did. They rounded up people. They went into the homes and searched your mind and found heresy, and then they whipped you and kicked you out and sometimes killed you. So that's like the caricature. That's, I guess, the extreme caricature. But the simpler version is that, well, they compelled religion. You are the wrong religion. You had wrong belief, and therefore I'm going to beat you until you get it right. Of course, all of that is ridiculous and silly, and that is not what happened by everyone's stated principle, at least. That is true even of New England. So if you listen to my podcast from a couple episodes ago on, I think it's entitled New England Persecutions, you'll hear all about that. And I think that clarifies precisely those historical situations. But what I want to do today is, of course, talk about liberty of conscience, but also get the issue right. Narrow down precisely what people believed in the past and how the moderns get it wrong. If you read a book like Andrew Walker's, I think it's Liberty for All, he just repeatedly gets this wrong. I don't think in the entire book he actually at any point accurately describes what everyone affirmed prior to, I guess, I don't know, in his telling, prior to the American founding period, I guess. But like almost every time he gets it just utterly wrong. And it's interesting because Rutherford, like I said, in the 17th century, he called them, quote, ignorant Anabaptists. And this is the way he said they framed the question. So it was, quote, whether the magistrate can force men with the sword to religious opinions and cudgel them out of some and into other contrary judgments in the matters of God. In other words, they thought, and people continue to think to this day, that you force men with bad religious opinions through the sword to then affirm the opposite opinion, that is the right opinion, okay? Rutherford, of all people, and again, he in his day was on the side of having a public religion and punishing heresy. Yeah, he was on that side versus like some of the independents of England who wanted to have more religious liberty, and of course the Anabaptists. And he denied that. He said that is not what the issue is. And he just straight up denies that you can even force people through civil sword to change their opinion. And that's not the intent. It would be unjust if you try to do that. Going even farther back to 1532, there was a synod called the Baron Synod. And Reformed Synod, and it produced this document, and this is what it says. It says, quote, no magistrate can compel the conscience or command and forbid with respect to anything more than what is outward. So it makes that distinction between the inward conscience and what is outward. So this is not trying to do with some sort of groundbreaking, like new, it's not like proto-religious liberty or proto-Roger Williams. This is just what everyone believed. You cannot compel the conscience because it's an internal form. It's between you and God. But you can forbid and command with respect to, as it says, things that are outward. Rutherford even says in his book, he says, quote, you cannot offer violence to mind, understanding, will, or affections of love, fear, joy, because all these illicit acts cannot flow from any principle but the internal and vital inclinations of the soul. Okay, so if it's proper to the soul or it's proper to the inward, you cannot bring civil power against it. I mean, imagine some like the civil magistrate saying, you know, you can't love this person like by command, like internally stop that affection in your mind. And if you don't stop that affection, I'm going to beat you. That's what he's taught. You can't do that. Same thing with belief. You affirm something because you're persuaded of something, even if it's like silly. The civil ruler shows up and be like, I'm going to whip you until you actually internally deny it. I mean, maybe they'll publicly deny it, but that doesn't mean internally they did. There is an interesting case study of this in 1984, the book, Orwell's near the end of it, by the way, that I often think about. But anyway, that's an aside. But so Rutherford then does give his shortened version of the question. And he says it is whether the magistrate can compulsorily restrain the external acts of the outward man in religion. So what he's saying is it's not a matter of, you know, this cudgeling and hitting people because of internal belief. But it's because it's the question is, may the magistrate restrain external acts of the outward man in religion? And he has a longer statement of the question, and I have one as well in my book, and I'll get to that in a moment. But that's a good kind of simple summary of the issue. And that alone, saying that it's about external acts of the outward man, pretty much destroys 90-95% of the characterizations of both my book or my view and also the classical position, right? I mean, almost all criticisms of here, everything from like Andrew Walker to Russell Moore to pretty much anyone else, even like the modern Two Kingdoms folks, they're going to say that someone like myself or people within the older tradition, they'll call it, quote, theocracy, and they'll say, oh, you just want to punish people for being heretics, for having bad beliefs. That's what it comes down to. But that's not it. You're restraining external acts of the outward man, okay? There's more to this, of course, so but that's a good kind of basic question, and as we keep going along, I think we first have to emphasize that there's a distinction between kind of internal and external religion. So internal religion is what God cares about the most, basically that you have a clean conscience towards God and Christ, and that you're reconciled to God by the mediator, Jesus, the God-man, Jesus. And that's the most important. So you worship from the heart is more important than the outward acts that you do. You affirm the gospel. You have faith in the gospel. That's internal religion. But you want to think internal religion just kind of broadly, even considering like false religion. This is something that the civil magistrate cannot touch. It's a matter of the conscience. It's something that cannot be, in fact, subordinated to any external entity. This is a good Protestant principle. That this is one reason why Protestants deny that. Well, this is why they accuse the Roman Catholic Church or the Pope of being a tyrant, an ecclesial tyrant, not simply for his ability to create ceremonies and these things, but also the fact that if he says you will believe X, then a good Roman Catholic is literally obligated on that ground alone to believe what he says. So he says, here are these Marian dogmas, and by the way, they're ex cathedra true. To be in the true faith, you must affirm them. This despite having no biblical evidence or even historical evidence in the church, in early church, nevertheless, on my authority alone, you believe. And that, the Protestants, that would be considered tyranny. But within Protestantism, you have to be convinced in your own mind of the truth of something. And the even if it's supernatural, it's a supernatural truth, you have to be convinced of it through the deposit of supernatural truth, which is Scripture. And the function of a minister is not to say, is not simply to say, I'm a minister, I'm some sort of mediator between God and man, and therefore believe what I say. He says, look what Scripture says, and he convinces you through Scripture. That's his role, is to point to you what God said and to exposit for you to then say yes and affirm. So the point being is that within Protestantism, there is an idea of the sacred rights of conscience. Now, the question of the right, the original right would be your right to discern and conclude within your own mind of the truth of something, okay? That's not to talk about external or expressing it or propagating that belief, but it does say that you have a right to not be beat by a sword to believe X internally, okay? So that's very important to distinguish internal belief and external belief. So Francis Turretin, 17th century Reformed scholastic theologian, he says this, quote, coercive power does not apply to internal faith, but is concerned with external acts over which the magistrate has power. For as an opinion of the mind is not to be punished, still neither is pestilent and impious profession to be endured. So you see here that he's distinguishing internal faith and external acts, and he says you should not use coercive power against internal faith or opinions of the mind, but only over external acts. Again, so sacred rights of conscience, or the idea of the sacredness of the conscience. And it's sacred not because we just like throwing around words like that. I mean, people do, but it's sacred because the conscience is you before God. Like that's why it's a sacred forum. And distinguish that with like a secular forum, the seculum, basically, because it's in a way kind of mediated through human authority. Whereas you have a sacred right of conscience in the sense that there is no human authority that mediates between that. Of course, Jesus as the God-man is a mediator of salvation, but it's a function of reconciliation between you, you and God in Christ. And so that's important. The other thing is you can't coerce. The other thing is you can't punish. Yeah, so you cannot punish on the basis of the belief itself. So his beliefs in themselves are harmless. They only harm the person who holds them. So if you hold a really horrible, awful, I don't know, terrible, damaging, heretical belief in your heart, and you don't say it, and it doesn't affect your behavior in any sort of noticeable way or detrimental way to other people, then it only harms you. And so for that reason, having a bad belief is so you don't, in other words, you don't put people up against a wall and say affirm this or deny this, and then you start punishing for that. It's only when the external act has some detrimental effect to other people in society that it can be considered harm and therefore restrained by civil government. Okay, so you don't punish simply for the belief itself. I say this directly in the book. By the way, it says, I say, hence the question is not whether civil authority can punish one on the basis in whole or part for false belief itself. I continue, furthermore, since civil power cannot reform hearts, we deny that the direct intent of civil punishment for false religion can be inward reformation. In other words, the intent of it, the direct intent, I mean, you could have like an indirect intent, but the direct intent of civil punishment for false religion is not to reform the inward heart. And why is that? Because you can't. You can't do that. There's another one, is that, so Jonathan Lehman, other people, and Andrew Walker have emphasized this idea that by punishing these people, you're prosecuting crimes against God. Okay? Now, there are some indicators, like in Calvin, other places, that do kind of talk about this, where you would sort of punish because you're dishonoring God. I just don't think that's necessary for my position. And they don't really cite anyone, that they just kind of assume, perhaps because of like they're reacting to some theonomist views. But that's not the position I would take, and I don't think it's a classical position. The classical position is is that you restrain those external acts of heresy and blasphemy because it harms other people in the community, because the civil ruler has authority to order the whole to good, right? So it's a matter of you do the good. I mean, you are sort of minister of God, but you're minister of God for the good of the civil community. You're not just working for God and that's it. There's actual, you have it, you're working on behalf of God for the good. And so this means that you prosecute the crimes against God. Now, against man. Now, Calvin does kind of suggest that, someone taking away the God's honor should be punished. But he does actually in this section, let's see, where is this? This is when his commentary on the Minor Prophets on one of the Minor Prophets. He says, he follows up with saying that these people destroy souls, they corrupt pure doctrine, they confound the whole order of the church. So he does mention this idea of defending God's honor, but then he follows it up by saying these people are also doing this and with the negative effects upon people. So that once we think through that, like we know that civil action cannot attack an inward religion. It's a matter of external religion, which is different. External religion would be kind of profession of faith. It would be ceremonies of worship, teaching. These things are outward and they're visible and they can affect others. Like your thinking in your mind cannot affect others. We don't have the powers of telepathy. Your outward expression can actually negatively affect people. And of course, we affirm this all day long. We know that in families, we try to restrain the sort of things that our kids watch on television and other places from like false things and damaging things, knowing that hearing the expression of ideas itself can influence people and harm people. So we already affirm this, right? So since we already affirm it, then it's not a hard leap, I think, to say that law can also act in this way. Nevertheless, when it comes to false religion, we still have to ponder and think through what the ultimate question is. And so I say here that suppressing false religion is a means, not an end in itself. I think this is a very important point. It goes back to what I said before. The civil ruler has within his purview the good of the community, and so punishing false religion is not an end in itself. It's a means to protect the souls of the community. And so this comes to this question then. The question is not whether the suppression of external false religion by civil government is a good in itself or ought to be pursued for its own sake, nor is a question whether civil government ought to prosecute all expressions of false religion regardless of their consequences and circumstances, nor is a question whether civil power can force one to speak outwardly what is true, for that would cause one to lie. All right, so what this means then is you don't find a false religion and round it up and punish it. It actually has to be harmful. The person who's babbling nonsense in the city square and what he says is false, you might want to suppress what he's doing because he's a public nuisance in a certain way, but you're not really afraid that people are going to take seriously his babblings. Okay, so that if he's harmless, you don't need to waste resources on him. But if something is harmful, you can, in principle, suppress. So that, and again, it's not an end in itself. There has to be, in other words, in order for you to suppress someone's idea, you actually have to have a reason for why it would be harmful to the community. You have to have a reason. So the fact that it's false is not sufficient, because false claims can be the sort of things that do not actually harm people. So I haven't got to the final question. Let me now state the final question that, as I put it in the book. Quote, the question is whether a Christian magistrate having civil rule over a civil society of Christians may punish with civil power false teachers, heretics, blasphemers, and idolaters for their external expressions of such things in order to, one, prevent any injury to the souls of the people of God, two, prevent the subversion of Christian government, Christian culture or spiritual discipline, or three, prevent civil disruption or unrest. Okay, let me say it again. I'll say it a little faster. The question is whether a Christian magistrate having civil rule over a civil society of Christians may punish with civil power false teachers, heretics, blasphemers, and idolaters for their external expressions of such things in order to prevent, one, any injury to the souls of the people of God, two, the subversion of Christian government, Christian culture, or spiritual discipline, or three, civil disruption or unrest. All right, so this is the question I lay out in the book. First thing to notice is I'm talking about a Christian magistrate. Also, it's a civil, so it's a Christian magistrate. Second is it's having a civil rule over a civil society of Christians. So if you are a Christian and you happen to be a civil magistrate over a civil society of non-Christians, then, well, you're not going to start punishing these things. And why would that be? Because it simply would not work. Let's say you have majority Muslim and somehow you are over a society of Muslims and you're Christian, then you're not going to get away with punishing false teachers, heretics, blasphemers, and idolaters. So that, again, you have to seek an end. Now, the end is, of course, you want to maximize the good of a community given its circumstances, and you have to use the appropriate means to that end. And forcing all Muslims in a Muslim country to go to church probably won't work. And in some ways, to their credit, and of course the application is wrong, but they would resist what is against their conscience. So they actually have the will to resist these sorts of things. You can commit all sorts of horrible acts against images of Christ and Christianity and Christians, and Christians don't do anything in the West about it. Muslims, if you just dare do a little joke about Muhammad, and you might, you'll see people in the streets. But anyway, the point being here is that it has to be a society of Christians. That doesn't necessarily have to mean it's a majority, or like 100% Christians. Nevertheless, the whole of it, the overall, the totality of it would be Christian. The second important word in this question is the word may, M-A-Y. The Christian magistrate may punish. Now, it doesn't say must punish, doesn't say ought to punish. It says may punish. That is, it's permissible. So the question then is not concerning whether the magistrate must do this in every case. It's an absolute command. It says may, which means that it is a permissible action to do. And it's only proper or suitable when it is prudent. It's incredible. I mean, people simply don't read. I mean, it's not just that people miss the may. I mean, throughout this chapter and throughout all the other chapters, I make it very clear that I'm distinguishing principle and permissibility and what's permissible and what's prudent. I go through this many times and people think this is like a Mott and Bailey thing when it's just basic political theory. It's basic classical political thought that you have. I mean, it goes back before this, but just take of like Aristotle's distinction of regimes, where he has a best regime, but then he also has, so the best regime would be aristocracy. But at the same time, you have to do what you can, and so a better regime, in fact, in certain circumstances, the best, the perfect would be the enemy of the good, and so you get the best you can. The same thing in this case. You may do it, but you may not. At times should not do it because it would destroy the Commonwealth. Althusius makes this precise point in Politica. He says, you know, that a Christian magistrate should not tolerate diverse religions and heretical religions, but, you know, if it's not worth destroying the Commonwealth over this question, because then if you destroy the Commonwealth, you destroy the church. Basically, you in the sense that if you don't have a well-functioning civil society, if you have civil disruption and unrest and people, just imagine in a civil war, if you and your immediate neighbors are fighting over things and you want to kill each other, you're probably not going to venture out to go to that church down the road and just sit there, you know. So the point being is that, you know, again, policy has to be prudent, but again, may punish. With civil power, so that's the power of a Christian magistrate is civil power. false teachers, heretics, blasphemers, and idolaters for their external expressions of such things. Okay, so it has to be an external expression, which I already mentioned that an external expression includes teaching and public statements, and perhaps it could be a monument. I mean, if you put a monument up of some anti-Trinitarian in the interest of anti-Trinitarianism, that would probably fall under that. But again, what's the end? What's the purpose? So that's the sort of things that you're countering, it's punishing, but what's the end of it? So well, again, injury to the souls of the people of God. And this one is probably the most controversial end or purpose of the of suppressing it, because isn't that the role of the church and all that? So I would just say that that outward things, outward speech can affect inward states. And if the magistrate has an interest in the good of the people, then, and this would also extend to the good of their souls. And so if they can properly suppress what would do damage to their soul, they should suppress that. The magistrates do have an interest just in our non-religious domain of trying to have tranquil, good mental health, tranquil states and psychological states, and because there's a recognized good in having sort of a tranquil mind. And this is why we have nuisance laws. This is why you're not supposed to drive by my house with your music blaring. This is why you have ordinances that say after 10 or 11 or midnight or whatever, you can't blare your music from your garage or have a party outside that disrupts the neighborhood. Why is that? Well, it's because it affects people's peace within their own home. It's a psychological thing. I mean, you could do stuff all day long outwardly, even with that sort of nuisance, but they have an interest in your peace of mind when you're in your own home. Of course, we have that interest as well, and so we have those ordinances for that reason. Now, of course, that's different in a way, but I'm saying we do care with regard to policy. Policies do have an end that is inward. And so that cannot then be the principle used against this sort of thing. Also, we recognize throughout today, not just the tradition, but basically we all recognize that outward things affect the souls of people. That's why within our own homes, we regulate what sort of things our children consume on the internet, on the television or radio or whatever, the stories they listen to, the things they read. We regulate all that because we recognize the obvious principle that those outward things, those speech or whatever, they affect our children inwardly. Okay, so we recognize that outward things can do harm, and so the magistrate can then, to my mind, and I think logically follows, they can suppress what could do damage to the soul. Now, they have to be careful when they do this, of course, and I'll get to that a little bit later. But I think in principle, they can do that. So the second reason was subversion of Christian government. So if they are trying to subvert the government, the Christian government, they can suppress these people. This could just be the government itself, but also Christian government. And this is something that, this is what accounted for some of the kind of actions against subversive behavior in New England Puritan era in 17th century. This would include Roger Williams. I mean, people don't realize. Listen to my episode a couple back on New England quote persecutions. This is also the Baptist at that time as well. There was a serious fear, and I think a legitimate fear, that Baptists would undermine the Christian aspect of the government. And today, what's interesting is that not all Baptists are like this, but among the ones who fill the institutions, there is this signal that if the Anglicans and Presbyterians and many of the Baptists were successful in kind of re-Christianizing our American institutions, that these Baptists would be a subversive element. That's what they would be. That they would try to subvert it, to revert back to a secularist so-called neutral or whatever they would call it, a set of institutions and public life. So they are declaring that they would be subversive to Christian government. So in circumstances, they could be suppressed, and I mean, hopefully they would just be denied access to institutional power. That's probably a better way to do it than having the magistrate throw people in prison. But that is one of those things where, like, I was talking to some friends the other day, and with a Baptist friend, and I was like, this is the difficulty here is that they are announcing their willingness to be subversive. Now, this is not just Baptists. This includes the modern Two Kingdoms people like Scott Clark and Daryl Hart and Michael Horton, those guys, Van Drunen. They're essentially announcing that they would try to overthrow, or they would work to undermine a Christian government. So it's very unfortunate. But again, yeah, those people would have to be in some ways like marginalized from power because they would undermine a Christian government. That doesn't mean prison. That doesn't even mean laws or civil sanctions. It could just simply mean that you people are undermining our way of life as reflected in our institutions, and so we're not going to grant you any sort of power in those spheres. So you also got Christian culture and then spiritual discipline. So two. Again, you can think of New England, and that was kind of their interest. They saw the Baptists as undermining spiritual discipline because the New England churches would excommunicate some people, and then the Baptists would take them in. So that was one way that was one charge against the Baptists in the early 1680s and 70s, that they would do something to that effect. It was also a charge against the Antinomians, because the fear was that the Antinomians would not take the discipline side seriously of the Christian life, and that would undermine what the whole project of New England. So that's and then civil disruption and unrest. So far, yeah, this would be the big one against someone like Roger Williams, and that their fear was that he was undermining the very foundation and encouraging civil disruption and unrest. I mean, you can imagine that if like the Quakers were the same way. So the Quakers were probably actually a better example than Roger Williams, though they're both examples of it. And so there is this, there are certain religious opinions and beliefs that would end up kind of causing civil unrest and try to overthrow the government. So anyway, so in principle, those are the ends. So it's protection of souls, it's protection against subversion of government culture and discipline, and also prevention of disruption, unrest on religious grounds. So probably the third one is probably the least controversial. But again, I'll just emphasize, it says may punish. I'm not trying to say like, oh, I don't mean it. I'm not serious about it. I do think it's perfectly legitimate, permissible to suppress heresy by the civil magistrate. So I'm not questioning that in itself, but I do think that a civil rulers must have resolve, and they must be courageous, and they must do what is difficult just to secure the good. At the same time, there has to be prudence. Prudence is not an excuse for cowardice, but it still has to be a function of public political judgment. So in the 19th century America, I should also say, in 19th century America, it's not only that it was a matter of prudence. This is one of those cases where the having being in a Protestant Christian order, political social order, didn't require It did not require this sort of civil action, even though there were blasphemy laws, there were Sabbath laws, but there just wasn't a concerted effort by civil authorities to undermine heresy. In fact, the 19th century is when a lot of heretical Christian sects kind of arose. You can think of kind of the big three would be Mormonism and Jehovah's Witness. And then even though Seventh-day Adventists have seemed to calm down a little bit, they would, at least classically, were considered kind of heretical. But those all rose in the 19th century, also Christian Science. But still, the religiosity among Orthodox Orthodox denominations of Protestantism were doing quite well in the 19th century. And so there was a sense to look around, there's religiosity, people are getting along, they're not fighting each other over religion, there's debates and there's disagreement, but no one actually wants to send out warring parties to go get others. Of course, there were incidents with Roman Catholics, I'm not denying that, but that arguably was more about the fear of the politics attached to Roman Catholics, which in a way is an understandable fear, even if irrational, it still was understandable. I won't get into that, but the 19th century was a time in which that you didn't need these sorts of actions to maintain high religiosity and orthodoxy within America. And even without kind of these official civil actions, Americans understood themselves to be a Christian people, and that's was essentially the case up until very recently. So if you want to take an American tradition, American political tradition, the American political tradition is understanding itself for most of its history, understanding itself to be a Christian people. Anyway, that's the question. And then you just go in there to argue for like the idea of public harm. So again, you can suppress a heresy, blasphemy can cause those three things. So blasphemy could cause subversion of government, damage souls of people. It could cause civil disruption. And for that reason, to secure those goods, they can be acted against. Now, again, if some heresies are not to be treated as if they are utterly damaging, sometimes they're expressed so ridiculously that the expression itself is actually undermines itself. So you have to, again, and this is my argument with regard to harm. This is a syllogism I have in the book. First premise is any outward action that has the potential to cause harm to others is rightfully subject to civil restraint or punishment in principle. So any outward action that has the potential to cause harm to others is rightfully subject to civil restraint or punishment. That's the major premise. And and the second is external false religion has the potential to cause harm to others. That's the minor premise. Therefore, the conclusion is external false religion is rightfully subject to civil restraint or punishment. Okay? That is in principle again. So if something can possibly cause harm, then it can be suppressed. External false religion can cause harm, and therefore it should be suppressed. Okay. That's my argument. People can disagree with it all day long, but that's it. So now the question the question then is, okay. I mean, when you go down the line, you can like on this argument, like the one objection raised is like, okay, well, I affirm that the syllogism is sound. We'll even say that it's sound, but the sort of outward actions, like the scope or the extension of outward action that's within the purview and cognizance of the civil government is limited to the non-religious things. Like it doesn't extend to religious things because they don't have any sort of principled cognizance is what I call it, principled cognizance of it. Because it's outward. So you can't know things about religion. And I provide several different arguments in defense that they actually, the civil magistrate can actually know these things. The first one is I referred to already is that they can know, like they have an interest in mental health, even though that's inward. And so the magistrate, though he can only affect outward things, he can know what is good inwardly and order outward things to inward good. Again, you can have these public nuisance laws when it comes to like noise discipline or noise, like reduce noise outwardly because that's good inwardly. So they do actually have an interest in the inward good. And so they can know knowledge of inward things, but at the same time, that doesn't mean they are mental health therapists or have knowledge of how to do good therapy. But they do have a sense of what is actually good what is good internally, what is a healthy mental state, even though they may not have be the person who can help in that regard. So analogously, he's not a pastor, but he can know that it's false, that tritheism is false, or that polytheism is false, that kind of stuff. Or bowing down to idols, he can know that is false. The other argument is that, so everyone kind of wants to say that the magistrate knows the second table of the law because it's written on our hearts, and they know, so they know the fifth through the tenth commandment. You know, so they know that you should honor authorities, they know you shouldn't murder, they know that lust is sinful, so they should know, like, pornography should be banned. They know that you shouldn't steal, shouldn't lie. And then the coveting part, you can't really enforce that. But the others you can enforce. And they know these things. And that those are kind of the ground, or they summarize the ground of civil law. But it seems to me, logically, if they know that there is this sort of natural law, then they would naturally know that it's enacted by a lawgiver. And they would know that this lawgiver is divine. Okay, so you can logically deduce. So we're talking about what a magistrate as a magistrate can deduce. Okay. So he knows there's a law. He knows there's a sort of natural law. It follows from there being a natural law that there's a lawgiver in nature or for nature. Okay. And that lawgiver, you'd know, would be God. It would be God as the lawgiver. And well, but if you can know the lawgiver, if you can know that God is, then you can also know that this God deserves worship, that he's the only God, that he is one God, that he is the only being that deserves our worship and our highest thoughts. And you can also conclude that this God is to be worshiped in a certain way, and that the things of this being ought to be honored. And I think you can even know that there ought to be, you know, some time, day set aside in our daily life to give our devotion to him. So that's the first four commandments. And all these follow logically from you acknowledging that there's a law of the second table. What this means then, if the civil magistrate can acknowledge a law, can acknowledge the law and its scope is the second table commandments, then he can also acknowledge and have knowledge of the first table as well. Follows logically from it. And so for that reason, if you want to talk about principled cognizance of what the civil magistrate knows, then he knows the first table of the law. And as the magistrate, okay, so that I think that's a pretty solid argument relying on basic philosophical, like Christian philosophical reasoning that goes, that's very old. That the argument that if there is a law, there's a lawgiver. That's a very old argument, and I think it follows logically. So you can't be a second table onlyist. Then to be a second table onlyist requires you literally to say that the acknowledgement of a natural law as law does not follow from that. That there is a God, okay? Which means you are committed to political atheism. Now, I know that second table onlyists don't say that. They say we are not political atheists. But if you are political theists, then it follows that the civil magistrate must acknowledge the first table as well, or he can cognitively get there. Like you logically get there. So there's an incoherence. If you acknowledge God, that God is, then it follows logically that God ought to be worshipped rightly, his things ought to be honored, that, you know, his name, and then forth ought to be worshipped, set aside. So it doesn't make any sense. It's incoherent. Yeah. Okay. So that's a solid. I do have another argument as well. You can see it in the book. But then there's a question of, okay, fine. Maybe all that only pertains to natural religion. Maybe the civil magistrate can only have like principled cognizance of the natural religious element, because after all, the first table is in itself a, you know, the first table itself is you could say natural religion, like it's the natural theology. But yeah, and my argument there, I think my strongest argument, I have all these arguments, I have three arguments against this, four, five, six. Wow, it keeps going. I think the stronger argument is, so if when you take like the first commandment, like it's, you know, no other gods before me, but if you take the positive side of that commandment, it's basically worship the one God alone. Like that's like worship God alone. That's basically what the first commandment is telling you, the command as a positive command is telling you. And that's, you know, that's just basic how what everyone, like all reformers basically affirm that's the positive side of the first commandment. But if you think about like who is like the God, like God alone, like who is God? Well, prior to scripture, apart from the revelation of the triunity or triune God, that God was, you know, you could say Yahweh, whatever, but it's just God is the God of natural theology, right? So if the God of prior to any revelation that Adam was to acknowledge and then immediately post-fall Adam was to acknowledge was the God of essentially natural theology or natural revelation. And that would be all true because that was the body of knowledge that was accessible by man with proper reason, okay? But after revelation, now there's a twofoldness. It's not two distinct revelations. It's better to think of a twofold revelation, which now is the complete revelation of God that we have. Whereas before, the complete revelation was limited to natural religion, natural theology, what you could attain by reason and whatever God disclosed kind of in the garden. But after scripture, now we know that God is there, we know the Trinity, which really means that natural theology in its totality is actually false. That's not to say that the elements, the things within it are false, but in relation to the fullness of revelation, the twofoldness of revelation, natural theology is actually false. So the first commandment is not saying worship the God of natural theology just worship according to natural religion. It's not saying that. It's saying worship the God alone. The God is the triune God. All right? So what this means then is that if your doctrine of God is nothing but the doctrines derived from natural theology, then it is false theology. False in its totality as a whole, even if the elements of it are true. Why? Because the fullness of revelation is, the triune God. This means that the first commandment post-revelation, given the twofoldness of it, is commanding you to worship the triune God alone. This means that the third commandment is commanding you to honor the name of God and, broadly speaking, the things of God, which would be his word, the sacraments, the name of Christ, all these things that are actually part of the second of the twofoldness of the revelation. This is why the second commandment says worship God rightly. Well, that includes things that are part of the further revelation, the sacraments, that you're to worship through Christ. Those commandments are fulfilled through the twofoldness of the fullness of revelation. And so what this means then is that the civil ruler can know, in order to fulfill those commands, he can't simply just do public religion or a natural religion or natural theology. In order to fulfill the first commandment, if he's going to apply the first commandment to its fullest, he has to apply it for the triune God. All right, so that's really important, because you don't want people to say, "Oh, I affirm natural law, and so it only refers to natural theology." Well, no, that's not right. That's not what it separates the revelations. It makes in a way makes two gods. This is like, it goes back to the question as to whether like non-Christians worship the same God. There's an important distinction there, is you can say yes in a way, or like, do they direct their thoughts to this one God? In a way, you can say yes in some of the content, because they'll affirm simplicity or something like that. But in terms of totality of their object of their worship, they are not. We are not worshiping the same God. It's a basic misunderstanding of it. It separates twofoldness into two different deposits of revelation that are separate from one another. When really the fullness of it renders an incomplete version of it false. Okay, that's the argument there. Let's see. Yeah. All right. So that's my argument for why the civil magistrate can know and apply scriptural like further revelation in the public sphere. I'm kind of getting away. That's in this chapter, but I'm kind of getting away, I guess, a little bit from the main point. But the main point earlier, I just to reiterate, the main point was to clarify the question and also to bring in what exactly you are doing when you are suppressing these false things. Again, you are trying to achieve some good in the community. It's not an absolute command from God that you do these things to the detriment of the community. You are charged as a civil ruler to do good to the community with resolve and courage. Okay, that does not mean that does not mean that you do things and destroy the Commonwealth. All right, so that's the liberty of conscience. And in the end, I state the principle. So like instead of repeating the question, the principle, it's kind of a restatement of the question in a way, but the principle I have is that the civil magistrate may restrain outward expression of false religion that in his judgment can injure souls or subverse Christian government and threaten disruption and unrest. And he restrains in order to establish and maintain the best outward conditions for his people to live a quiet and peaceful life in all godliness and honesty. That is the end. That's the end of civil rule. Civil rulers are working on behalf and for God. They are ministers of God. But what are they charged to do? They're not a sort of like they're not delegates who have like God gives them a body of law and says here it is, and then you enact and you enforce it no matter what the conditions or circumstances on the ground. That is not it. This is why I emphasize a civil ruler is a type of mediator, not mediator of salvation, but a mediator of civil rule. God wants people to be ordered, to be ruled, and to follow what is just and what is good. And the civil ruler is the one who is supposed to be on the ground, understand circumstances, understand the principles of natural law, and from that derive these civil or human laws that would order the people to the best possible outcome. So again, it's the, like I said, restrains sin in order to establish or maintain the best outward conditions, the best possible outward conditions for his people to live a quiet and peaceful life in all godliness. Now, if this could mean that, let's say you are the Christian population is 10% of the population, the rest are non-Christians of some sort. Well, in that situation, what are you going to do? You're going to seek out some kind of religious liberty. Right, you're going to seek after from the civil ruler, you being able to live a quiet and peaceful life in all godliness and honesty. So in other words, you're not being harassed. You have protection from the people around you, and this is in the Middle East and other places. This is Christians have sought this repeatedly from civil rulers, and American foreign policy actually has been very detrimental to this, and in fact has destroyed the Christian communities in Iraq and elsewhere. Because there was a sort of delicate balance that they were bad guys like Saddam Hussein. Nevertheless, they had these connections and these agreements with Christian communities for protection. So, but if you're 90%, you might grant the 10% non-Christian religious liberty, but just like in these other places, they are tolerated. Right, so that the rest of them would, like Christians in Iraq couldn't go around like trying to subvert Islamic government, like they couldn't do that, and if they did, they'd be, you know, it'd be a bad day for them. So the same thing in a Christian community, if you're confidently Christian, you can tolerate non-Christians at the same time not tolerate their acts that would seem to subvert that Christian. Yeah. The last thing I've mentioned it many times, but like prudence, I think this is something to beat up on, like just to keep repeating. Prudence, again, it's prudence is recognizing that you have a means to an end, and the means have to conduce to the end, and different means, given circumstances, given differing circumstances, will conduce to the same end. So you could have a situation where religious liberty is good for the actual good, and then you have times when religious liberty could be bad for achieving that good. And so you have to kind of navigate that. You have to navigate that given the circumstances. So this is a quote from Johannes Althusius. I've mentioned him a few times already. He says, "The magistrate who is not able, without peril to the commonwealth, to change or overcome the discrepancy in religion and creed, ought to tolerate the dissenters for the sake of public peace and tranquility, blinking his eyes and permitting them to exercise unapproved religion, lest the entire realm and with it the household of the church be overthrown. He shall therefore tolerate the practice of diverse religions as a skilled navigator bears with diverse and conflicting winds and clashing waves. Just as amidst these winds and waves, the navigator brings his ship safely into harbor, so the magistrate directs the commonwealth in a manner that keeps it free from ruin for the welfare of the church." That last line is important, for the welfare of the church. Why would he put welfare of the church in there? Of course, there's other considerations of like civil justice. But the welfare of the church, the instituted church, is the administration in which you ordinarily receive the highest goods in this life. The goods of word and sacrament that point you to a better country, a higher country, a heavenly future. And so this is how the civil magistrate principally supports your highest good, and that would be keeping in mind the good of the welfare of the church. At the same time, this is precisely why you should not support the church to the destruction and ruin of the kind of non-church elements of society. And that's because the non-church elements, civil society, civil peace, are in a way preconditions for the good flourishing and welfare of the church. If you have utter anarchy and civil war where neighbors are shooting at neighbors, you're not going to be able to come together to worship God ordinarily with in the church. And if you did, it'd be extremely dangerous and probably many people die and many people just would not do it if neighbors are shooting at each other. Okay, so it's better to maintain civil peace so that people can attend and worship God in church and receive the highest good and worship God with the others. All right, so again, you have it's the highest good, but the highest good needs these lower things. Just like when you go to church, I've said this before, I said this to Daryl Hart, when you go to church on Sunday morning, at least for us Protestants, you try to get a good night rest, and you eat something in the morning, and you drink some water, you have a little coffee, many of us, like myself, we get a little dressed up so we have the right frame of mind and know what we're doing, and we show up, our outward body is now prepared to do what you do at a church, which is to engage your mind and body in worship. And so, of course, we think that these outward bodily things, these earthly things, are necessary as sort of like they're ancillary. They're not the thing that engages the worship, but they are this ancillary, like necessary supportive element that permits you to have this engaged heart in worship. So the same thing would be for the civil realm. When you have a tranquil, well-functioning civil society, that means that the people there can then go to worship at the instituted church without hindrance and without disruption or being molested by the world. So that's what this is all about. So when we talk about, I guess as to conclude, there's other questions too I could talk about. I've already mentioned I guess I could talk about like briefly some of my conceptions of religious liberty in the American context. One of the things that's been frustrating and not totally unsurprising, I just didn't want to feed certain psychological habits, but in a way they just ran with them. But when I say like you can persecute heretics, that's again a matter of principle. This book was not written for only Americans only. So I don't have any problem in principle with another country saying this is heretical and therefore we're going to suppress it. But in the American religious tradition, there is wide toleration and religious liberty. So I always think of the 19th century. Again, I mentioned this already, but that you have high religiosity with pretty much a very, very kind of free religious expression. And that was perfectly fine. So I kind of want to return in a way to the 19th century, where everyone understood this country to be a Christian country, and they sought to protect and make the institutions Christian in kind of word and deed, and at the same time would permit and tolerate the dissenting, like even dissenting Christians or dissenting non-Christians to that. But permit them with confidence, knowing that the position of this country as Christian is secure, and that these people are not going to be permitted to undermine that, which was for most of our history was the case until I think after World War I, and especially after World War II, we basically allowed the subversives to take over, and we are what we are today. So I want to return to the 19th century of that kind of strong confidence, but also tolerating it. And that's perfectly consistent with everything that I say. Again, in my question, I say may punish these or restrain these people. I don't say you must do it. I think, and if you've listened to my podcast on New England persecution, you'll say that I have some sympathy for the New England Puritans. They came to Massachusetts and Connecticut. They came with a very specific purpose, and that purpose was to found a colony or colonies in the congregational way. The majority were on board with that, and then all of a sudden you get people like the Baptists showing up, and you get people like the Quakers showing up, and then the Antinomians, that's a little bit more complicated. We have these people show up, and they start saying, wait, that's not it. We're not doing that. We're not going to follow that with you. And so the congregationalists like, well, we have something going here, and we're not going to let you try to subvert it. You are tolerated, but you're not allowed to subvert. And that's precisely why the congregationalist churches did receive Baptists and Antinomians and Presbyterians into their churches as full members, full communion members. And yet they would not tolerate erecting a Baptist church. They, of course, did not tolerate the Antinomians eventually. They did not tolerate Roger Williams, precisely because, hey, we have something here. Why did you come here when you could go to, I don't know, Virginia? Or now you can go to Rhode Island, like later on. Go to Rhode Island. Why are you here? it's illegitimate in that context to then begin to suppress those dissenting and sometimes disruptive people in that context, whereas it would not be appropriate today to do things like that or in the 19th century. And for the principles I've already laid out. So, all right, that's liberty of conscience. I don't know if I keep repeating myself. It's one of these things where so many times in the book, I mention the distinction between permissible and emphasize, well, you may do this. And I'm not saying this has to happen in every single case, and it doesn't matter. I mean, even someone like some of the people associated with Michael O'Fallon, like Bill Roach, he'll put that up there. He'll read it out loud. It says, may do this. And then in that same context, I'm saying, you don't have to do this. It's not a command, absolute command. And they don't, it doesn't matter. Like, people wonder why, like, I block people on Twitter, right? Or people wonder why, I wrote a whole book. I wrote a whole book on your book, and you haven't responded to it yet. Yeah, well, if you read my entire book, then that means you've read the 15 to 20 times in the book. where I clarify the difference between essentially permissibility and prudence. I mean, in the chapter on, oh, then they say things like, oh, you want to drown Baptists. We're literally on the chapter on liberty of conscience. I have a section on prudence, the whole section on prudence. I even mention the Baptists, and I say, I mention Baptists several times in the book. And I say things like, no, we need the Baptists. I don't want to persecute Baptists. In New England, it made sense at a certain time, given the context. It doesn't make any sense to do that now. I cite people like Jeremiah Burroughs and Richard Baxter, who basically say that we need to extend toleration. We need to have this charity towards our Christian brothers. But no one, they don't care. So it's like just a lot of what they want to do is they read something that says, okay, well, you can punish heretics. They get a conclusion from the book that is very useful to them. They get the conclusion that Wolff wants to bring back, 16th century Geneva. And then when I say, no, that's not what I want because we have to be prudent, that jars with their useful tool of attacking me. They came to a conclusion, oh, it's extreme. Wow, I can post this on Twitter and show like how extreme Wolff is. And these other things are just me trying to do like the Motte and Bailey, where now I'm walking it back. He tries to walk it back. He tries to say, America, we don't do those sorts of things. It's stupid. It's stupid. It's embarrassing. I lay out the argument. I establish these things and no one cares. But that's fine. In the end, it's like free advertising. What's funny is that like I get frustrated by it, but I have to remind myself that it's so kind of ridiculous that by now enough people have read the book and they know what I say in it that I can just tweet or they'll tweet out like, this is just not at all what he says. And you're not serious. You didn't read the book. Do the reading. And they say, I did do the reading. And it's like, no, you didn't. Didn't do it well enough. You read what you read the conclusions you wanted to read to attack the book. And then you kept those conclusions. Now there have been people to their credit, there have been several people who did come to those initial conclusions. And then they heard my explanation. They heard things that I've said in reply. They did go back and read the book and said, yeah, okay, yeah, that is right. That is what you wanted. That is what you said. And essentially, I've got several emails from people saying, I apologize for what I initially said. And now, like, even to this time, even like some of these people who were harsh critics are now fans and friends, and I've been on their podcasts and we've talked. And so it's fine. It's not everybody. It does speak, but again, like people, this is what you do, is that instead of dealing with arguments of the book, instead of thinking critically about arguments and refuting arguments, the easy thing to do is to take the things that you can post on Twitter, the screenshots or the quotes, and to just simply leave them outside of the systematic argument, and which in the end is like a ninth commandment violation. It is they're essentially lying. Like to mislead about what someone believes is to essentially lie about the person. We've all done things like that in the past, but the thing is, once you corrected, are you actually going to then back off? Because in the end, because of the nature of our world, I'm kind of going on rabbit trails here, but the nature of our technological world, people are not interested in refuting arguments. This is one of the interesting things when you actually read 17th century political works and theological works, is they knew that they had to refute the arguments. Like to be a serious person, you had to say, this is a fallacy, or you didn't support this conclusion, or whatever. You have to actually refute. Today, you don't really have to refute. You just have to make it look scary. You have to make it look like it could be dangerous. You have to do this performance before a normie crowd or a female crowd that judges everything based upon what is scary to them, or not even female, effeminate. really just, it does, there are plenty of women who are not like this. But it's just an effeminate thing. In fact, most of the time it's men doing this, but it's also women. Women are some, anyway. Yeah, like instead of refuting, it's all about making things as scary as possible. It's scary. All right. Well, I'm rambling on enough, and I don't even know how long I've been going. Over an hour. Man, no one is still listening. If you are still listening to this, you are a trooper. That'll be enough for today, so go away now and have a great rest of your day.
Went down to that river, washed my sins away. Praying for another day. I went down to that river, washed my sins for free. The devil's on the other bank, staring back at me. I'm a dead man walking. I'm a dead man walking. I'm a dead man.